Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the drumbeat of war that is drowning out alternative approaches to the crisis in Syria, and go to Ireland to speak with Patrick Coben, the Middle East correspondent for the UK Independent, where he has an article, "Only a Peace Conference, Not Airstrikes, Can Stop Further Bloodshed." We'll discuss his contention that the slaughter of civilians by chemical weapons is both a crime and an opportunity, and examine the possibility of pursuing peace before the trigger is pulled on war. Then we will speak with Shibli Telhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and the author of The World Through Arab Eyes. We will discuss Syria as the third and most recent Arab country to face civil war after enduring decades of dictatorship, with Iraq and Libya in chaos after being liberated by US and NATO military force. We will look at the prospect of avoiding the destruction and division of Syria, which is caught in both a regional proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran and a wider contest between the US and Russia, both of whom do not want al-Qaeda to take over Syria. Then finally, we will speak with David Courtwright, an American scholar and peace activist who is the director of policy studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. We will discuss alternatives to the use of military force in Syria that are not on the table, and the disconnect between an almost unanimous call for military action from political leaders, while only 9% of the American people support the U.S. going to war in Syria. Joining us now from Ireland is Patrick Coben, who has been a Middle East correspondent for over three decades, first for the Financial Times and currently for The Independent in the United Kingdom. His latest article at The Independent is "Only a Peace Conference, Not Airstrikes, Can Stop Further Bloodshed." Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Coben.
Thank you.
Now, it seems that the drumbeat of war started with the French foreign minister, followed by the British foreign minister, and then Secretary of State John Kerry. And while it appears that the president is about to pull the trigger, you have written an article suggesting that the horrible chemical attack in Damascus on August the 21st is both a crime and an opportunity.
Yeah, I think that, you know, these airstrikes are going to happen. Those involved the U.S. and France and Britain already committed to it, and they're not going to walk away from this, so that's going to happen. But, you know, what happens afterwards? And I think that the reason I think it's an opportunity is that the chemical attacks show that you can't just leave the Syrian civil war to rage on and hope that it won't drag in outside powers, that it won't affect the area. So I think there's a stronger motive. It's given a shock to everybody, a stronger motive for having a peace conference, and to look, at least at first, simply for a ceasefire to stop the level of violence ever escalating and Syria disintegrating.
Well, of course, there are specialists over here in the national security community who are suggesting that you can sort of separate this Syrian civil war and all of the intractable issues involved there. And there is, of course, an asymmetry between the fact that the Russians, the Hezbollah, and the Iranians seem to be determined to back the Assad government, but the West and the United States has been extremely ambivalent about who to back on the other side. But given that asymmetry, there's this belief that somehow you can do a punitive military strike as a signal against crossing the line, the red line, over the use of chemical weapons, and somehow not get involved in the outcome of the Syrian civil war.
Yes, I think, I mean, that's clearly Obama's dilemma. The British and the French seem less concerned about getting involved, but they're not sort of leading the pack on this. The U.S. is. I think that it's difficult to balance. Obama will. They want to give the Assyrians more than a slap on the wrist, so I think it'll be the attacks will be pretty wide ranging. On the other hand, they don't want to be in the position that they were in Libya, which they wanted in Libya, which they were basically trying to and succeeded eventually in overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi. At the time, there was something of a pretense that this was the militiamen, but actually it was NATO that did that. I don't think they want to be in that position. And it's a very different situation. As you just mentioned, Russia and Iran and Hezbollah are very committed to supporting the Syrian government. They're not going to just fold their hands and go away. So it's a difficult balance to achieve.
But in your article with the UK Independent, Patrick Herman, only a peace conference, not airstrikes, can stop further bloodshed, you make the point, which I think is important, that Syria has a failed government and a failed opposition. And if indeed the country disintegrates, which it's been doing in this slow and agonizing way, it will eventually be overrun by warlords, and there'll be even less of an interest in peace. So you're making the case, I guess, now that it's either now or never.
Not quite, no. I mean, now or never for a peace conference, yes, because it gets ever more difficult. There are ever more players involved. You've got to... who exactly would represent the opposition? You know, within Syria, there are about 1,200 groups, big and small, involved in the fighting. Some of these are very tough, you know, are affiliated to, some of the biggest are affiliated to Al-Qaeda. On the other hand, there are some positive things that all these different groups on the government and the opposition, the rebels, are dependent on outside backers, so they can be pressured. In the middle of the war, I mean, particularly one as bitter as this, I don't think that you can have long-term solutions to Syria's political problems. What you need to do at this stage is have a ceasefire, have the UN there monitoring and supporting that ceasefire, and then if you can bring down the level of violence, maybe you can proceed then to longer-term solutions. But the alternative is just the war going on and the war getting worse and worse.
And again, I'm speaking with Patrick Herman, who has been a Middle East correspondent for over three decades, first for the Financial Times and currently for the UK Independent. His latest article at the UK Independent is "Only a Peace Conference, Not Airstrikes, Can Stop Further Bloodshed." Now, in your article, Patrick Herman, you say that peace conferences have the best chance of succeeding when one side knows it has won and wants to formalize its victory, while the defeated wants the best terms possible. Alternatively, peace negotiations may be productive when both sides are exhausted and come to realize they are not going to win a complete victory. So which of those two scenarios do you see as most likely, or is it a combination of both?
I think the second is most likely. I mean, we have a stalemate at the moment. The government had some successes. It took an important town called Kuzair, but it hasn't been able to advance much further. The opposition has taken some places. Basically, you've had, really for about a year now, you've had a stalemate, and I can't see either side defeating the other. I mean, it's also both sides have a core of support that isn't going to put up its hands and is going to fight to the end. So I'm not sure that that in Syria the government or the opposition think that way. I think they both think that if they play their cards right, they might come out an outright winner. But I think that that's completely unrealistic. So you have this bloody stalemate going on, and you need them to realize that this is not going to change and force them to go to a peace conference.
Well, of course, nobody, I think, imagines it's going to be easy to get these two sides, you know, how do you get negotiations going between people whose primary aim is to kill each other, as you point out. Now, I have spoken in the last couple of days to a former CIA officer, Robert Baer, who was the character that George Clooney played in the movie Syriana, and he spent a lot of time. He's still on the phone all day with the Alawite officers and with the rebels and stays in touch with the country and speaks their language. And then yesterday I spoke with the English language spokesperson for the Syrian local coordinating committees, the umbrella group for the opposition And in the case of Bob Baer, he said that for the Alawites, this is existential, that they believe that there will be no mercy shown, so they have to fight with their backs against the wall. On the other hand, when I brought that up with the Syrian spokesperson for the opposition or for this, whatever this Free Syrian Army really is, she said, no, it's only the Assad family that feel this existential threat. So where do you come down on that?
It's sort of the problem is the opposition doesn't really address this fear among the Alawites, actually among all the minorities. A lot of people just work for the government of what's going to happen to them if the opposition win. You know, you have these people, let's say, you know, you're sitting in Damascus. You can't really go out much in the evening. There isn't a lot to do. You're watching the internet. You go to YouTube and you see pictures of Alawite officers having their throats cut. You see pictures of, priests being having their heads chopped off by jihadis. So, you know, not surprisingly, you think, you know, I'm going to fight to the end. There's no, I've got no alternative. And the opposition doesn't really, has never addressed these fears, which is one of the reasons that the government has been able to hang on. They just sort of are in denial and sort of pretend it isn't happening. So what has happened, and this may have changed a little because of these horrific use of poison gas, but you know, you have a lot of people in Damascus and elsewhere, Syrians who don't like the government, but wish the government would go. But then they look at the alternative, and they think, you know, that might even be worse.
Well, more recently, we've seen examples of the opposition, particularly the al-Nusra people, in the ethnic cleansing of Syrian Kurds, who literally thousands just flocked across this rickety pontoon bridge across the Tigris to escape into Iraqi Kurdistan, fearing for their lives. So there's some evidence that life under al-Nusra will not be particularly pleasant.
Yeah, I mean, there are 2 million Syrian Kurds. I mean, that's 10% of the population. And these people are in flight, you know, and there are thousands of more trying to escape. So, you know, that's part of the disintegration of the country. You know, in a way, it's sort of in the interests of these extreme groups and indeed of the Assad family to keep a war, to keep make sure that everybody is thoroughly frightened of everybody else. If you do have a ceasefire, then there might be a bit more political space in which there could be changes. You know, there are plenty on the government side who don't like the opposition, but they don't much like Assad either. But so long as there's a war, you know, you don't really have time to think about these things. You're just fighting the enemy.
Well, it's clear there that this has become a proxy war, isn't it? I mean, and you do have the Saudis on the one side supporting al-Nusra and the Iranians on the other. So, and then outside of that inner circle, if you will, you have the outer circle of the United States and Russia. And more recently, President Obama was characterizing his dealings with Putin when he canceled the summit meeting after the G20 by literally characterizing Putin as a sort of scowling, surly schoolboy sitting in the corner. So the prospects of the U.S. and Russia talking aren't particularly good, are they?
Well, they were going to, I mean, on some things like, you know, Snowden, not good. But on the other hand, if it hadn't been for this poison gas attack, they were meant to be having a quite serious meeting to set up a peace conference. That's now been cancelled. Maybe it'll happen later. That they have quite a lot in common. They don't want this to spin out of control. But, you know, the problem, as I was saying, is that there are so many players involved now, Saudi Arabia and Qatar. You know, you have about five different struggles in going on in Syria. You had one at the beginning, which was you know, the people against a dictatorship. That sort of, to a degree, still goes on, but it's also a sectarian struggle of the Sunni against the Alawites and the Shia. You know, it's an international struggle of Saudi Arabia and the U.S. against Iran. It's the touch of the Cold War, U.S. against Russia. So all these sort of struggles are going on simultaneously, and they sort of cross-infect each other, and they make a solution very difficult to achieve.
So in terms of the political DNA of the West and of Russia and the Soviet Union, is there a difference? In other words, so much of what we have been told over the throughout the Cold War and since is that the defining moment was the appeasement of Hitler, was Chamberlain, and that we can't afford appeasement anymore. And I think that's the subtext for this argument over the use of chemical weapons, that you simply cannot appease the use of weapons of mass destruction. Is that an argument, do you think, would appeal to the Russians? And if you go back to appeasement in World War II, of course, you have the Hitler-Stalin Pact. So give me a sense.
Yeah, I think the Russians probably privately pretty appalled by this. I mean, for strategic as much as moral reasons. But, you know, and when you think of it, it was incredibly assuming, I suppose, one, the evidence isn't all in, but it's very difficult to think of any alternative candidate other than the Syrian army to have used poison gas on a mass scale. I can't believe the opposition would have the capability of a sort of mass fake. But the Russians say, well, you know, it's wait for the evidence and so forth. But it's reasonable for Kerry and the others to say the evidence is largely in. But will the Russians, how will they react now? They'll stick with Syria. I mean, this is one of the new things in the situation, or something we haven't really seen for 20 years, is Russia behaving as a powerful state with an important ally that it's going to protect. It hasn't really done that since about 1990, since the first Gulf War and the final years of the Soviet Union. It's been too divided or it's been too weak. But in Syria, they're going to stick. Iran and Hezbollah, well, they've been, you know, they read early on that getting rid of the Assad regime was one of the main motives was to weaken Iran, weaken Hezbollah. So they think if we have to fight, we'll fight now. So I don't think any of those allies of Assad are really going to change their stance.
But given that I think the Russians have obviously told us privately, and I believe Kerry and Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, have supposed to have a good relationship, that surely the Russians have pointed out that they're much closer, their Caucasus are much closer to Syria, 500 miles, and that they're afraid that the same kind of people that are giving them trouble in the Caucasus are going to end up running Syria. Now, you would think that on the American side, they would recognize that the U.S. would have blood on its hands if al-Nusra were the winner here, if al-Qaeda's affiliate. After all, we have this war on terror that's supposed to be aimed at al-Qaeda. It's the idea that the United States would allow the al-Qaeda people to take over and slaughter the Alawites and the Christians and everybody else that they don't like. That's an intolerable thought, too. So you'd think that there'd be some common ground between Russia and the United States.
Yeah, there is common ground there, I think, which was why, you know, Kerry and Lavrov agreed some earlier in this year, in May, to have a Geneva peace conference in Geneva. But, you know, there are other things that enter into it. The Russians say, not unreasonably, that the Iranians are big players in this and they should be there. But the U.S. is confronting Israel and Saudi Arabia, confronting Iran over nuclear weapons. They don't want to sort of recognize Iran as a regional power. But if you don't have the Iranians there, then it's very difficult to have a serious peace conference. So, you know, that's what I meant by saying that a whole series of different confrontations have sort of all been come together in Syria, which makes it so difficult to reach any solution or even have a conference of any kind.
But the point that you make, though, is certainly resonates, that this horrible crime could also be an opportunity. And I don't see anybody thinking in those terms. I just hear the drumbeat of war.
Yeah, there is at the moment, and maybe it'll just go on that way. And certainly, you know, that's not unexpected. If they're about to launch airstrikes, they're not going to... what they want to do is batter and frighten the Assad government. So, but the question is, what happens afterwards? Are they going to support the opposition in the belief that ultimately the opposition will triumph? On the other hand, that, for the reason you just mentioned, is not probably not good news for the Syrian people, and it's not good, and certainly not good news for the U.S. to find an opposition in power in Damascus in which the most powerful military elements are linked to al-Qaeda. So if they don't want that to happen, what's the alternative? Well, the alternative, I think, should be, as I said, to and there is, Russia and America are in a position to pressurize their allies, their proxies on the ground. There is a conference, and as I said, I think sort of the initial thing would be to see if a ceasefire can be arranged to have the UN there. This isn't going to be perfect. It isn't going to last. But, you know, ceasefires, even when they're periodic, mean that a lot of people don't get killed who would have been killed otherwise.
Well, Patrick Cabin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
No, thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Patrick Coburn, who has been a Middle East correspondent for over three decades, first for the Financial Times and currently for the UK Independent. His latest article at the Independent is "Only a Peace Conference, Not Airstrikes, Can Stop Further Bloodshed." We're going to take a brief station break and we're back with a further perspective on the idea that there might be an opportunity in this crime.